From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Huey P. Moe has produced hit records for Archie Bell and the Drells, the Sir Douglas Quintet, Freddie Fender, and dozens of Gulf Coast performers. His records were soulful, but so low-tech they were described as having the bathtub sound. A visit with Huey Moe on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, the music of Brian Ferry. In the 70s, he headed the art band Roxy Music. Now he has a solo career and an upcoming U.S. tour. Brian Ferry takes a look back on his recording career. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new album by cellist Yo-Yo Ma, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg takes on that American educational competition, the Spelling Bee. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. His nickname is the Crazy Cajun. He's also been called the godfather of Gulf Coast rock and roll. Huey P. Moe is a Houston-based record producer who's had a lot of hits, combining the blues, country, Cajun, and rock and roll sounds of his birthplace, Louisiana, and his home, Texas. He discovered, then produced hits for Doug Somm's group, the Sir Douglas Quintet, Freddie Fender, Archie Bell and the Drells, and Rockin' Sidney. He's also produced records by Jerry Lee Lewis, T-Bone Walker, and Clifton Chenier. Huey P. Moe was born during the Great Depression. His family was poor. His father couldn't read or write. Moe got his start in music, performing at house parties with his father's Cajun band. Moe says he was too hot-tempered to hold down a job, so he went to barber school and opened up his own shop. But he couldn't keep out of music. He didn't think he was much of a musician or singer, but he loved working in the recording studio. This was Moe's first big hit, Barbara Lynn singing You'll Lose a Good Thing. It rose to number 8 on the charts in 1962.
If you should lose me, oh yeah, you'll lose a good thing.
When you recorded that record, You'll Lose a Good Thing, you were still working in a barbershop in Texas.
Yes, in Winnie, Texas, southeast Texas, where it is, by Beaumont, Port Arthur. It's called the Golden Triangle. It's home of the Big Bopper.
Now, how did you first hear Barbara Lynn? Would you tell us the story behind that?
I was working in the barbershop, and a guy brought me a tape, and he wanted me to hear somebody called T-Baby Green, which was a blues, real blues, down-home blues act. And in between, he wasn't knocking me out, but in between the tapes, it recorded, I had a little Walden sack in him there, and it was recorded on there, and I could hear this girl singing in between. Somebody had recorded over her. And she was just knocking me out, and I said, man, just, you know, I'd give anything to work with that voice. You look at the voice and the song, if you can marry them together, that's the secret to it. And so that one day a guy by the name of James Young, Big Sambo Young, he passed away last year, he come in there and I asked him, I said, James, who's this girl singing right here? He said, oh, he said, it's Barbara Lynn. He said, you want her? I said, yeah, I'd like to have her. And so he'd come back down there by 6:30 at night, they were just closing up, and he had Barbara with him. Played a left-handed blues guitar and just sang her butt off. It was just too much, man.
You said the main thing is to match the right voice with the right song. Did you pick the song for her to sing?
She had sent me a tape after this thing that had 5 songs on it. You Lose a Good Thing was among 5 songs, and I said, that's a hit. And I didn't have the money. I had to get her to I paid the band in New Orleans in the studio, and I bought some Sid Roebuck tape, and I asked if she could make it to New Orleans where I'd record the song, because I thought it was great.
Well, you didn't have the money, but that song ended up making you a lot of money. It was a big hit in 1962.
It still does.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, you had Freddie Fender re-record that.
Yeah,
because
I've already re-recorded. Songs of Timeless, the great songs of love and the sentimental heart affairs, always timeless. They live forever.
So when you made a lot of money from that song, did you get out of the barbershop?
This was my first check. It was real weird. I got a check because we was very poor. My daddy couldn't read and write even when he died a few years ago. We were very poor, and I had a check from my friend here, Harold Lipsis, here in town, for $48,000. And we had never, none of my family all put together, had never seen that kind of money. And I put it in a little bank in Winnie, Texas, and 3 days later, here comes the Narcotics Bureau, the Internal Revenue, and everybody. And I didn't want to make any more money. I thought making money was dangerous, you know. So that's the story behind You Lose a Good Thing. Yes, it was.
They couldn't
first...
believe you'd gotten that money legally, huh?
No, everybody thought I was doing something else because we never had no money. You made $75 a week in the barbershop, so, you know, how could you come up with $48,000? I had a check.
Let's talk about what the record industry was like back then.
Okay.
And how you got into it. Now, you'd started off in the music business actually playing in a band with your father.
Right.
Why did you want to give that up and end up behind the mixing console producing records?
Well, see, my father and I played because it was a weekend thing where we picked up a little extra money. We played what we call house dances, you know, where people would pass the hat around because we was very poor. And so that we'd do that only on Saturdays, you know, and finally I got into the radio show on Saturday on KPAC Radio in Port Arthur. And so I got interested in recording, you know, because we did a tape one day and I got interested in recording. So it always interests me. I love music so much, and I like rhythms. You know, I've always been a rhythm and a song man. And to me, if I have the song and a great melody and a great song and a nice rhythm, well, all the background don't mean nothing to me. They called it sweeten up. You know, you sweeten up this and sweeten up that. And it's okay, you know, if it needs it, you know. But I'm the person that likes to do it if you don't need it.
Now, you were working and still are working out of Texas. When you were getting started and you were working in a production studio out of Texas, you had to figure out ways to make your records not only regional hits, but national hits.
Yeah.
What were some of the techniques you would use for getting national attention to some of the regional sounds that you were
producing?
Well,
I think it's making hit records like making love to your favorite lover. You know, the feeling is there. It's an emotion, and it's great. It's a great feeling. It has to be there. And if you put that feeling in your records, then everybody in the world's going to feel it.
Yeah, but you still have to get it out on the radio stations
sure,
and get it to a big label
distribute
it.
I went and put that out in Louisiana and Texas, and the records became so big down there that the big labels from New York and up here would come down there to get it. It was a thing that was fresh. It was grassroots, fresh music. And it was different. It was very hard to get it into New York and make them understand that music. But it worked, you know. It worked. It would be the last outpost to break it at, but it would always work.
What, New York would be the last place to play
records?
Yeah,
last outpost. Because it was so... New York has a problem with they like a copy music, something that sounds like this or sounds like that, something. And a lot of the record companies have a hard time hearing something that is original and that is fresh. And New York is a fast-moving pace city. If you make the wrong decision, you're out. Somebody else got your chair and your job next day. So to make decisions on a completely new sound is very hard job for somebody in New York City, and I understand it, you know.
Did you take your records on the road and play them for DJs to get them played on the air?
Yes, I did. I took them on the road. I did everything I had to do.
Everything you had to do? What are some of the things you'd have to do?
I remember coming to Dick Clark. When I first met Dick years ago, he played records for me. He's a great man.
This is Dick Clark?
Yes.
So what would you have to do to get airplay on radio stations or on bandstand?
Well, in them days, you did everything. That's before me and the Alan Freed days, you know. You just did it. I remember when the first little transistor radios came out, you know, it was a big thing, the small ones. But a friend of mine had a European import in New York. I just went back home with a truckload of them. At Christmas time and all over, I'd come around. Well, here's your transistor. Give your wife one. Give your kid one. Everybody. It was a favor for a favor. You know, it's the way our system of government is based on today, you know. And then they invented the old nasty word payola, which is a bunch of bull. You know, I never believed in it because that's the way you elect your people, anybody.
Would you use money as well as gifts?
Money, sure. One guy in New Orleans wouldn't take money from me. I remember taking a $50, $100 bill and throw it in the trash can and walked out. And I knew he wasn't going to let the guy clean that trash can and take that $100 bill out of there. I get in my car and all of a sudden hear my record. And I didn't mind it, because if that's the game, that's the game.
I want to play one of the many records that you've produced. And let me reintroduce you first. My guest is Huey Moe, who's one of...
Huey P. Moe.
Huey P. Moe,
name,
okay.
Name after Governor of Louisiana, right?
Okay. And he was really like the record producer, the independent record producer in Texas, producing a lot of hits, some of which we'll get the chance to hear today on Fresh Air, such as this next record that we're going to hear. And I want to play She's About a Mover, which... You produced. You discovered the Sir Douglas Quintet.
Doug Sam, right? Mm-hmm.
Doug Sam, right? Now you. This was 1968. No,
65.
I'm sorry. 1965. Mm-hmm. That this was a hit. It was about the time of the British invasion. It was
yes,
in the middle
was.
Of that
big invasion too.
Now, did the British invasion knock your records off the charts?
It knocked everybody's records off the charts. They just took over the country.
And so you had to react to that and figure out a way.
It was a matter of they called eating.
Right. So tell us the story about why you named Doug Sam's group the Sir Douglas Quintet.
Well, I had this idea. I was just trying to figure out the world. I'd figure the world, you know. And I knew that that Doug could play anything. It always bugged me to record. But I knew that I had to have something that sounded a little British, a little different, a little this and that. And it had to be something that came from London, because if it didn't come from London, the disc jockeys wouldn't play it, you know. And I had 8 or 9 records on the charts when the Beatles hit in every form, and this knocked me smooth off the charts, so I had to go out and find me somebody, you know. And I came up with Doug Sam, and his name was Douglas Wayne, and we tried to get some of them that would sound British, so we came up with the Sir Douglas Quintet, you know. And we did a number and come and wrote some songs off of Lake Charles two-step my daddy's play. Just use that beat and mix a little Chicano rhythm music along with the Cajun music and came off with the song. Doug wrote the song and we recorded She's About to Move and the Rains Came and then went on and told Walt McGuire to leave my name off of it and just put the Tribe record distributed by London Records. And
leave your name off of it so it wouldn't be a giveaway that
no,
it was from Texas.
No, it wouldn't be a giveaway. No, and so that it worked. You know, everybody said, oh, wow, here's another record from London. Bow! You know, up the charts it went. And it was fun watching it go.
Let's give it a listen. Okay, you can really hear the regional southern sounds in that. Did it work? Did people really think
sure,
that
fresh,
Sir
know.
Douglas was British?
Yeah, and he picked up an accent. He learned
did
that
he
accent
really?
Down T and had to tighten up Beatles suits for a while, you know, and all that. And he was good at it. The whole band was.
You know, your sound was nicknamed the bathtub sound.
Bathtub sound, because I never did care about a clinical clean sound. I went more for overtones and feelings, you know, that filled all the speakers in the room, like the mono sound. And God still makes them today. They'll tell you they're stereo, but they mix them down to mono first and then turn around and add a few little left and rights, you know, and it's still full.
Now, once the Beatles started recording in their, you know, a few albums in when they started using fancy stereo techniques mm-hmm. and recording backwards mm-hmm. and everything, mm-hmm. did you feel that to be competitive that you had to get out of the bathtub sound and start making more polished recording studio sounding records?
No,
I didn't.
Mm-hmm. I never believed in trends. I never believed in following anything. I always believed in going by my heart and my feeling and let it rip. You know, if it's got a feeling, it'll make it on its own. If it doesn't, it won't. Just like the Don't Mess With My Toot-Toot, right?
Those
two, three instruments, and Boyd played it all himself. So how do you answer that?
Now, during your career, you've recorded a lot of black performers and white performers.
Right.
Have there been different ways that you felt you had to break both of those records, different places to take them to, different programs to
sure.
get them on?
Even different mixes.
Really? Different
your black, yeah, your black mix is a rhythm dance mix. Your bass and bass drum has to be out. Your country or your white rock and roll is what call it back then would be more of the guitar strumming, and the voice would be out a lot further, and the harmonies would be out a lot further. So you started with your mix right away. And you had to I always like to mix both of them together, because a song is a song and the mood's a mood. And if it felt good, it felt good, and it would feel good to anybody. But you had to go. You had to start with your rhythm and blues stations first. If you had R&B record in them days, nowadays you don't have to, you know, because the black and white kids are together and they like each other's music. But they had a way of separating it back then, you know, and it was terrible. But you had to go that way.
Did you ever fool a radio station or a program into thinking that a white group was black or vice versa?
Many times, and but I didn't know that. See, in my heart, my mother was like me. She was free and unprejudiced from anything, you know. And I just never did like the prejudice feeling among people. I believe it's a hang up with people, you know, regardless if you're black or white or what. But so I cut my records for a feeling. I figured that everybody would like this ice cream. It tasted good, you know. And so sometimes, especially I run into more trouble up north, coming up north here, when I had a white act that sounded black. Then anyway, because the minute I would put him on the American Bandstand, if he was white, he sounded black, he fell off the black charts the next day.
Oh, because they realized that he wasn't black.
Yeah, right. You know, and it's things that that you walk through life, the fields of hatred sometimes, and you meet on the other side. It's pretty when you make it through.
Now, you talked about the black mix being different than the white mix
sure.
in the recording studio. I want to play a big hit that you had with Archie Bell and the Drells, Tighten Up. Talk about the mix in this.
Well, Archie Bell and the Drells, the Tighten Up was an opening to the show. And but people liked it. He would say, "Hi, y'all, this is Archie Bell and Drell. We're from Houston, Texas, ta-da-da-da." And then he would start his dance like that. And the people would get off to that, and I kept watching them. I said, "Maybe we ought to just record the introduction to the thing and put it out." And it became a hit record, even though we was pushing the other side of it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, called it's a dog's eat dog world. And a friend of mine in Chicago came in drunk at traffic time and put it on the wrong side in Chicago, and all the phones lit up. And so Tighten Up became a hit.
Oh, God, what a great story. Let's hear it. Archie Bell and the Drells, as produced by my guest, Huey P. Moe. And he's known as the Dean of Texas Independent Producers. He launched the careers of the Sir Douglas Quintet, Archie Bell and the Drells, Freddie Fender. We're going to be hearing more of the music he's produced after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Record producer Huey P. Moe is my guest. Now, we just heard a hit that you produced for Archie Bell and the Drells.
Right, mm-hmm.
One of your biggest hits was with Freddie Fender, Before the Next Teardrop Falls, which...
In fact, if I could back up just a minute, I got this gold record on Archie Bell and Drells Tighten Up when I entered the penitentiary in Texarkana. Jerry Greenberg had sent it there, and they presented it to me. There, of course, I couldn't keep it. I'd send it my office.
Now, let's explain. You were in the federal penitentiary
right.
for
mm-hmm.
a short amount
sure.
of time
mm-hmm.
on charges of violating the Mann Act,
right.
which is
mm-hmm.
taking an underage mm-hmm. woman mm-hmm. across state
mm-hmm.
lines.
Mm-hmm.
So you got this gold record right before you went into prison?
As I went in.
As you went in?
As the policemen were bringing me
oh,
in.
Oh, no, literally. Yeah. Oh, gosh. So
so that's what I did. I tightened up.
Were you a big hit in prison? Did everybody know your music?
Oh, yeah, everybody knew. I had some of my friends in there, too. Disc jockeys were in there, too, and different people I knew.
Huh. And when you got out, that's when you hooked up with Freddie Fender, who I think had also been in federal penitentiary for a while.
In fact, that's why Freddie signed up with me. I asked him why he was signed up with him, because I couldn't figure it out, you know. I was still mixed up for about 2 years then. And he said, well, I've been through the same things you have. And he said, I feel like you don't understand me. And that's the way it worked out, you know.
Now, you had him, did you pick Before the Next Teardrop Falls?
Yes, I did.
Record?
I picked every hit song you ever had, and he hated every one of them we recorded.
Why did you think that Before the Next Teardrop Falls would be a good song for Freddie Fender?
Well, I don't know. Freddie was going through some changes, and I had lost a sweetheart about that time, and that song matched the mood and the down times I was having at the present times. And so that it was a song that she'd left me for another guy, and the lyrics in it, if he brings you happiness, and I wish you both the best, you know. And so it matched me, and not only did it match Freddie, Freddie was going through the same changes then, and then just happened to be the one that made it for us, you know.
Well, one other thing. This was recorded as a country song.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you had him sing the lyric in Spanish
right.
In the middle of the record.
Mm-hmm.
A kind of maybe risky thing to do for the country charts?
No. I've always been against the grain. I'm independent and hard-headed. I've always been against the grain. I felt like that it was time for Spanish that thing to come on up front. I had produced a lot of Spanish hits over my lifetime in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And so that when I talked to Fred, he didn't want to sing it. He said, I can't sing that gringo stuff, man. And I said, well, do it for me, because I wanted him to do it for me, because I wanted to play it for somebody that had left me. See, and so they just fell right in that slot, and bam, it's a home run. And we had a lot of them after that.
Well, this is that record.
If he brings you happiness, then I wish you both the best. It's your happiness that matters most of all. But if he ever breaks your heart, if the teardrop ever starts, I'll be there before the next teardrop falls. Si te quiere de verdad y te da felicidad.
That's really a great record. That was a gold record for you.
Yes, probably sold 8 million by now.
You were the other day telling our producer, Amy Sallet,
mm-hmm.
that you finally decided to try to play one of your gold records.
Yes, I did.
Tell me what happened.
In fact, it was this record here, Teardrops, because I've had over 52 gold records, and I always wanted to do that. So when they presented me this for Next Teardrop Fall, I got all wasted one night, and I was sitting in the office. I said, I'm going to try that. Took it out of the frame, and I played the metal part, and it was the Supremes record, when I love gold.
Did you feel cheated?
Well, no, it was just funny. I always liked something fresh and something new, you know, and it was something new that I often wondered, you know, was it really my record that made they spread the gold paint on it, you know, but it wasn't. It was somebody else's, which is okay with some good people.
Oh, God, it seems so silly to do that.
Yeah, I know. Nobody but me do that, I believe.
Is there still a regional sound?
Sure.
In Texas, there's still a regional sound?
There's natural sounds everywhere, you know. It's just a matter of people believing in what they're producing. The problem I see with young producers, mm-hmm. if they're listening today, I don't have to tell them what to do, is that they need to diversify and teach themselves to produce different types of music. They get hung up in the heavy metal, and nobody likes Bon Jovi and a Striper and everybody better than I do. I love them. I love the song. Per song, not per album, per song that I like to hear them do, you know, just they might go on an album I don't like. But I think that the young producers should do as I did over the years and teach themselves to produce the opposite of what they're producing this week, next week, the complete contrast. I think they should teach themselves to produce a little country and shoot a little white rock and roll, I guess you'd call it, the backwoods rock and roll with a southern flavor and the heavy metal. And I think they should go from one to the other and not get stuck in the rut, because what happens, they'll pass them up, their little streak of luck's going to go down, and they're in trouble. You never hear from them again.
Now, right now, you're not really producing records much, right? Or at all?
Well, I'm just getting ready to start in January of this coming year. Okay. I've been together putting my blues magazine stuff together.
Okay, so you've been putting together a blues catalog of, mm-hmm. of your records.
Right.
You've been buying up copyrights and publishing rights to
right.
other songs, including songs by Isaac Hayes.
Mm-hmm.
How come you've taken a break from actually producing and recording?
Well, I do that. I've done that all my life. I go out and make some money. I go out and make money for about 4 or 5 years and cut a lot of hits. And then I said, the hell with it. I go play. I play for 3 or 4 years, and then whenever money's running a little low again, you know, when I said, and then I get the blues, and then it's time for me to cut another hit record. And it's getting out of the way now.
One of your many nicknames, I think, is the Crazy Cajun.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
What makes you so crazy? How did you get the nickname Crazy?
I started a radio show in Port Arthur, and I used to get drunk and get up and scream and holler while I spin my music and foot stomp and stop my records in the middle of all that. And people got to writing in the Crazy Cajun. They didn't know my name. A lot of them still don't. So I kept Crazy Cajun and made a publishing company out of it. I became a very big publishing company. And so the name of Huey P. Moe is a... secondary to most people in the business, know me as a Crazy Cajun.
You're about to, you will soon be going into the recording studio, you say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's give a listen to the last big hit you had a couple of years ago. This is Rockin' Sidney, My Toot Toot. Now, I want you to tell us how you found him and why you had him, do this.
Good.
Tell us how you found him.
Rockin' Sidney has been around, I recorded him 25 years ago. And the guy that he and I produced him together had a big falling out, and it was ironically that we got back together on producing this. And Rockin' Sidney played all the parts in that. He played all the instruments. He's a great writer. He's not the greatest listener on earth, but he's a great writer and a great person. But that's how we come about. That comes out of Lake Charles, Louisiana. He comes from a little town called La Compte, Louisiana. That's where he's from.
Well, before,
he's a great person.
Before we hear this, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been such a pleasure to have you here.
Well, I'm glad to be here. I want to tell Ed Ward and Austin hello, and he's the one that called me up and told me, and called Amy up, too. I thank you all for inviting me.
We thank you for coming, and thanks for all the listening pleasure you've given us over the years.
I thank you, too.
My guest has been record producer Huey P. Moe, and he's been recording music along the Gulf Coast for decades. Some of the hit records he's produced include Roy Head's Treat Her Right, My Toot Toot, which you're about to hear, by Rockin' Sidney, Tighten Up by Archie Bell and the Drells, and the Sir Douglas Quintet's She's About a Mover. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Rockin' Sidney.
With my toot toot. Now you can have the other woman, but don't mess with my toot toot. When she was born in her bird suit, the doctor slapped her behind. He said, you're gonna be special, you sweet little toot toot. Now you can look as much, but if you much as touch, you're gonna have yourself a case. I'm gonna break your face. Now don't mess with my toot toot. Don't mess with my toot toot. Now you can have the other woman, but don't you mess with my toot toot. Fais pas ça.
On the next Fresh Air, I'll talk with cultural historian Peter Gay about his new biography of Sigmund Freud, I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, singer Brian Ferry looks back on his career, a career that's included founding the British art band Roxy Music and collaborating with Brian Eno. Ferry is about to kick off a summer tour of the United States. We also hear what's new from cellist Yo-Yo Ma. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of Ma's new album of Schumann's Cello Concerto. And if you used to find spelling bees humiliating and a little pointless, you'll be interested in today's commentary by linguist Jeffrey Nunberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The House of Representatives has approved a plant closings bill and a trade bill. Both were approved by large enough margins to guarantee an override of a possible presidential veto. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
The Congress passed a trade bill in May, which included language requiring that companies notify employees 60 days before shutting down a plant. President Reagan objected to the plant closing provision and vetoed the bill, much to the delight of Democrats, who looked at polls showing that the vast majority of voters approved of the provision. The Senate then voted a separate bill requiring the plant closing notification. The House today did the same. Then the House moved on to approve of the trade bill without the plant closing language. The Senate is expected to take up that measure soon, and President Reagan will probably sign it. But the president has indicated he will veto the plant closing bill, much to the dismay of many Republicans who fully expect the measure to become law and would like to avoid the political consequences of another presidential veto. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan today predicted that U.S. economic growth would remain strong through the rest of this year, but begin to weaken in fiscal 1989. Greenspan told the Senate Banking Committee that the Fed's Policymaking Committee has raised its forecast for economic growth from 2.75% to 3%. The financial markets have been concerned that the strength of the U.S. economy will ignite inflation as workers demand higher wages and as businesses reach full capacity. Greenspan told the committee that signs of rising inflation prompted the Fed to take a series of restraining steps from late March through late June. Presidential candidate Michael Dukakis went before the NAACP convention in Washington, D.C. today. Many of the delegates to the nation's oldest and largest civil rights organization wanted Dukakis to choose Jesse Jackson as his running mate. Today, Dukakis introduced them to Texas Senator Lloyd Benson, the man he picked instead. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
Michael Dukakis told the crowd that he supports many of the issues they support. He said he would have a civil rights commission that believes in civil rights. And not only would he support sanctions against South Africa, he would sponsor them. He said his administration would crack down on terrorists everywhere, from Beirut to Johannesburg. Dukakis was applauded, but when he introduced his potential running mate, there were scattered boos. Benson told the NAACP members that if they cared about civil rights, appointments to the Supreme Court, and the leadership of the Justice Department, they had to vote Democrat.
When the issue is equality of opportunity or rights, I really don't believe there's a choice. The difference is real. It's apparent. And it's important.
Afterwards, many people said they were still disappointed that Dukakis had not discussed why he chose Benson over Jackson. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
Official sources in Athens say the United States has been told to remove its military bases from Greece by June of 1990. The sources today said a formal letter of notification from the socialist Greek government was delivered to the U.S. Embassy in Athens. The U.S. maintains four major military bases and 20 smaller installations in Greece under a five-year agreement which expires in December. Greek Prime Minister Andreas Papandreou has said his government will continue negotiations on a new agreement, but there's been no progress in eight rounds of talks. Papandreou promised to close all American bases in Greece when he was first elected in 1981. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 11 points to close at 2104.37 on Wall Street today. Advances led declines 7-6 on volume of 219 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange rose 13 cents. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of the new album by cellist Yo-Yo Ma. Lloyd says even though Ma's one of the world's greatest cellists, his recordings have often been disappointing, but for reasons that weren't Ma's fault. This time, Lloyd's not disappointed.
So far, the only one of Yo-Yo Ma's recordings that has really allowed him to shine is his album of Bach cello suites. In the greatest music he has recorded, he always seems to be compromised by his collaborators. So except for the Bach, which he plays alone, his best recordings are of minor works. Finally, though, CBS has released a recording of a wonderful work in which Ma gets the support he has usually lacked. This is his new recording of the Schumann Cello Concerto, and it is taken from a live performance given in Munich in 1985. It's with the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, and the unusually sympathetic conductor is Sir Colin Davis. Given how relatively few large-scale works there are for cello and orchestra, it's surprising the Schumann Concerto isn't better known. It's a major piece from the height of Schumann's career. It was written in 1850, the same year as his orchestral masterpiece, the Rhenish Symphony. This concerto doesn't get either as intimate or infectious as the more familiar piano concerto, and it's not quite as much a showpiece, but it's full of charm as well as grandeur, romantic yearning, and nervous energy. Its melodies are heroic, yet sinuously alluring. The supreme recording of the Schumann Cello Concerto is the one made by Pablo Casals in 1953, 2 years before Yo-Yo Ma was born. And it's still pretty amazing, extraordinarily personal, both more soulful and earthier, grittier and more playful than any other performance I've heard. In fact, it might not be such a good idea to listen to Casals before playing anyone else. Even Yo-Yo Ma seems a little tame in comparison. Ma's version is smoother, warmer, yet more patrician, especially in the big opening movement. It's not so much an inner drama as an act of contemplation, a thinking out, and how good it is to hear a conductor and orchestra not merely give strong support, but play the role of an equal. Listen to the way the orchestra converses with Ma's cello. It responds as if it were playing chamber music. Thank you. Emmanuel Ax, Ma's frequent piano partner, is his accompanist here in three other Schumann works. Ma's version of the five pieces in folk style is so different from Casals's that it's hard to resist a comparison. For Ma, these are elegant salon pieces, sly, urbane, and insinuating. Casals pretends they are real folk music and makes a more vivid comic point. Also plays several chamber pieces that Schumann originally wrote for other instruments, but that Schumann's publisher indicated could also be played on the cello. And in these, without Casals looming behind him, Ma is truly incomparable.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music critic for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Yo-Yo Ma performing Schumann's Cello Concerto with the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir Colin Davis. It's on the CBS Masterworks label. This is Fresh Air. Next month, British rock singer and songwriter Brian Ferry begins a 30-city U.S. tour, his first in 5 years. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has described Ferry as an archly romantic songwriter who sings in a bored, aristocratic crooning style. Ferry founded the group Roxy Music in the early 70s. In the early years of the group, he was joined by Brian Eno, one of the first rock musicians to experiment with synthesizers and other forms of new technology. Roxy Music broke up in the early 80s. Ferry recently recorded his seventh solo album, Bête Noire. I spoke with him last December in New York after the record was released. And you inside me, like poison, like wine. Now there's no sense for me, save your mind. Brian Ferry grew up in a coal mining town in northern England. He studied painting and ceramics at art school before moving to London in 1968.
After I graduated and moved to London, that's when I started to learn a bit of piano and I started writing my own songs, and then it started to feel as if I was really creating something, you know. And those songs became the first Roxy album.
Well, when you put together Roxy Music, you were, what, about 25 years old?
Mm-hmm.
That's actually pretty old for someone to put together
oh,
the
yes.
first band.
Yeah, right. So I think I had a lot of kind of music in me by then. So the first few years, I did a lot of records. It was all stored up, as it were.
What was the sound you had in your mind when you put together Roxy Music?
I don't know. It was to try and do something which didn't sound like what other people did. It was one of the ideas. I was influenced by so many different kinds of music, not only black American music, which was probably my main source of inspiration, but you know, Indian music, Arab music, all kinds of ethnic things as well. And having been to art school, I'd been kind of familiar with art music, people like John Cage and Morton Feldman, this kind of thing. So it was kind of... we were interested in kind of experimental sounds. You know, we had a synthesizer, which was quite rare at that time. And so we used to treat the instruments to try and make them sound a little bit different and so on, and even the voice sometimes. So it was always an adventure. Each thing was, it was really exciting, you know, because there was, we didn't feel there was anything else that sounded like that.
You were still basically an amateur when you put together Roxy Music.
I still am.
But did you feel like you operated on guts a lot of the time?
Oh, yeah, because we didn't feel particularly skilled, but the attitude was strong. And it was kind of, even though it was kind of arty music, as it were, it was very emotional. And we felt our hearts were in the right place.
You started performing in tuxedos and elegant jackets. Did that image for you come from movies or from other music groups?
Came out of desperation.
What do you mean?
Well, no, the first year or two, we kind of wore pretty outlandish costume. We thought, well, let's make this a bit of a theatrical experience. So we would kind of... nobody was really doing that at that point, so we felt that was an interesting thing to do. And after a year or two of kind of, you know, the sort of rather strange costumes we wore, it seemed a natural thing to do something a bit different and into suits and a more kind of anonymous look, you know. It seemed to be a strange juxtaposition of images or something. And it seemed to capture people's imagination, perhaps too much, in fact.
You mean because it drew attention away from the music itself?
Yeah, a little bit, yes. You know, you always have to be aware of that, because sometimes an image, if it's too strong, can get out of hand.
One of the first records that you recorded was an album of pop and rock standards called These Foolish Things. And what you recorded on it ranged from Leslie Gore's It's My Party to Bob Dylan's It's a Hard Rain Gonna Fall and the standard These Foolish Things.
Yeah.
And you sang them with a lot of irony. Mm-hmm. And I thought that irony was partly your attitude toward the songs, but also your attitude toward yourself, because you didn't think of yourself as fitting the image of the people who'd sing those songs.
Right, yes. It was after the second album. And it was great fun to do. We did it in about 3 weeks, which was very quick for me. And I particularly liked the title track, These Foolish Things. I like to do songs from that period where perhaps you're dealing with a song rather than a great recording, you know, because that song's been done so many times that you never think of one specific recording of it.
The smile of Gobbo and the scent of roses, the waiter's whistling as the last bar closes, the song that Crosby sings, these foolish things remind me of you.
What were the things that you felt that you lost and that you gained when Roxy Music broke up and you went your own way as a solo artist?
I think it's just that you get a bit tired of being tied to the same people as if by a piece of rope, you know, and you think, well, does it have to be like this for the rest of my career or whatever? And there are certain things that you miss from making group recordings, the kind of the shared responsibility, say, you miss a bit, and the kind of the mass hysteria and sort of enthusiasm that you get from working with, you know, other people who are sharing a project can be very strong.
One of the songs on your new record is called Kiss and Tell, and the opening of the lyric is 10 cents a dance, it's the only price to pay.
Oh, yeah.
Why give them more when it's only love for sale? Is that a bit of an homage to the songs 10 cents a dance and love for sale?
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. I like to make references to old songs sometimes. You know, I like songs from, like period songs, I suppose, from the period when they were well-crafted and written by songwriting teams sometimes, you know.
Earlier on, we established that when you started to perform and you were still really an amateur, you felt like you were performing a lot on guts.
Yeah.
And you implied that you still feel that way?
Well, I think you're always learning. I think it's a very healthy attitude to have. Nowadays, I kind of play with some of the best musicians in the world. I'm very lucky to know a lot of really good players, and I learn from them all the time, I think. Especially since the last two albums, say, or last three albums, were kind of difficult to make and took a long time. So I felt, and they were pretty complex, you know, because there are a lot of musicians on there, a lot of parts. They're quite complex. Hopefully, I could imagine the next album being a bit simpler than the things I've been doing. I feel I've kind of done what I had set out to do a little bit, you know.
By simpler, you mean less highly produced?
Yes, maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, just a kazoo and a pair of tap dancing shoes.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Brian Ferry's latest album, Bete Noir, is on the Warner label. Ferry begins a 30-city U.S. tour August 3rd in New Haven, Connecticut.
10 cents a dance, it's the old price to pay.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see how All Things Considered is shaping up. Alex Chadwick is guest hosting, and he's joining us from National Public Radio in Washington. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Terry.
You're going to be doing more on Dukakis' selection of running mate Lloyd Benson?
We are. Political correspondent Linda Wertheimer is going to take a look back over the last several years at Lloyd Benson's record to see just what kind of a senator he's been, make some guesses about what kind of a vice president he would be and administration influence. We'll also cover Michael Dukakis' speech today to the NAACP, his speech to the Civil Rights Organization coming one day after he did not choose Jesse Jackson as his running mate.
What other stories are you working on?
Well, there's the ambassadorial dispute between Nicaragua and Washington, and we're going to the zoo to see the world's largest lizard.
Thanks, Alex. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We've all been through the ritual of the spelling bee and the knot in the stomach as the words progress in difficulty until you're up against a word like onomatopoeia. Now our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg tells us the spelling bee is all ritual and no substance.
A lot of people are concerned about the levels of literacy skills in the American workforce. But few of them have taken the rallying cry back to basics quite so literally as William Olston, the chairman of a national temporary help agency. With a cooperation of a number of companies, the Olston Corporation held the second of a series of regional spelling bees for grown-ups in Secaucus, New Jersey, a couple of weeks ago. The winner was a 40-year-old mental health counselor who walked away with an all-expense-paid vacation in Curacao. Now, the spelling bee is a fascinating American custom, one of the last vestiges of 19th-century education that's preserved in a pure form. No other nation has anything like it, not even the British, who have to wrestle with the same spelling system that we do. But to think of the spelling system as a means of providing people with basic literacy is sort of like thinking of the Japanese tea ceremony as a means of providing people with liquid nourishment. The spelling bee is pure ritual. At one level, you can read the spelling bee as an enactment of the ideal of democratic competition that our schools are supposed to foster. The rules are the same for everyone. There's no subjectivity about right and wrong answers. And unlike other subjects, spelling gives no special advantage to those children who merely happen to be brighter or more creative than their classmates. The wonderful thing about English spelling, at the fourth grade level at least, is that it makes no sense at all. A powerful intellect and a vivid imagination are no help when it comes to figuring out that it's I before E in friend and the other way round in weird. In fact, the spelling bee is carefully designed to detach spelling from the actual skills you need for reading and writing. You don't have to know what the word means or how to use it in a sentence. You simply have to be able to spell it. Last year, for example, the National Student Spelling Bee was won by a kid who nailed down his victory by spelling the word ratatouille. This is an impressive piece of trivia to carry around. With only average luck, after all, you can go through an entire literate life without ever seeing ratatouille in print or even on a plate. Some of the contestants protested this particular decision on the grounds that ratatouille isn't really an English word. But the fact is that the best spelling bee words are never really English. They're dictionary words like viridescent and innominate and mythopoeia, words that exist not to be read or written, but only to be spelled. In theory, I suppose somebody could win a spelling bee without knowing how to read or write at all, the way some toddlers can tell you how to spell their name without being able to write it down. As it happens, the spelling bee originated at a time when children were taught spelling as a purely oral skill. But the ritual significance of the spelling bee goes back even further than that, to an age when literacy was still regarded with a sense of mystery. You only have to think of those kids chanting the spellings of meaningless words like ratatouille and viridescent to recall that the English word spell also refers to a magical formula or incantation, as in cast a spell. The connection goes back to a time when the ability to read and write was associated with magical power. In fact, the Scots used to refer to sorcery as grammary, which is the source of our modern word glamour. For children, literacy still has some of that feeling of magic about it, which may be why the spelling bee is such a compelling exercise. And I can see where adults would find it entertaining as well. But I hope no one out there is mistaking this witchcraft for education.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. And if you don't know how to spell ratatouille, well, we won't hold it against you. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Next time I speak with Alice Hoffman, whose new novel, At Risk, is rooted in the question, how would I react if my child's classmate had AIDS? Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Used Guitars, the third album by pop singer Marty Jones. And Stephen Schiff reviews The Deadpool, Clint Eastwood's new Dirty Harry film. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Dan Cornwell and Deirdre Benzing. Our engineer is Audrey Vodlaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.